Hallo beim Im Museum Podcast. This is how we start because we're gonna do this interview in German.
Nein, I don't consent to doing it in German. I feel like I would sound so silly.
Hallo, ich bin Teda und ich komme aus den USA und ich bin ein Führungin aus dem.
Ein Führungsspezialistin.
Ja, das.
No, I'm not doing it in German.
Okay, so hallo und willkommen beim Im Museum Podcast. Mir gegenüber sitzt Taylor Murray, eine Historikerin, die im Belvedere über die letzten Jahre eine Tour ins Leben gerufen hat, die sich Turning the Page Representations of Blackness nennt. Eine großartige Tour, die immer ausgebucht war und aus der die Idee entstanden ist, eine Audiotour zu gestalten, die es jetzt überall zu hören gibt. Die Tour ist gratis verfügbar, man kann sie überall hören, man muss nicht im Belvedere vor Ort sein, um sich die Tour anzuhören. Die Bilder, die dort besprochen werden, sind nur Ausgangspunkt, über größere Themen zu reden, nämlich über Representations of Blackness in der Kunst, vor allem im 18. Jahrhundert. Und es gibt die Tour auf Deutsch und auf Englisch. Und ich würde sagen, wir spielen noch ein kleines Stückchen ein, bevor wir hier anfangen mit dem Interview mit Taylor. Und zwar von der deutschen Übersetzung von der Audiotour Turning the Page.
An meinen ersten Besuch im Belvedere kann ich mich noch gut erinnern. Obwohl das nun schon einige Jahre her ist. Ich war damals auf einem Date und wir sind einfach so durch das Museum geschlendert, bis wir plötzlich vor einem Bild standen, das meine Aufmerksamkeit auf sich gezogen hat. Es war das berühmte Porträt von Prinz Eugen von Savoyen, also von dem Menschen, der dieses Schloss hier errichten ließ und der hier lebte. Ein bedeutender Mann der österreichischen Geschichte. Aber ehrlich gesagt, interessierte mich Prinz Eugen überhaupt nicht. Ich glaube, ich habe ihn nicht einmal richtig wahrgenommen. Was mir bis heute in Erinnerung geblieben ist, war die Person direkt neben ihm. Eine schwarze Person. Ein schwarzes Kind, ein schwarzer Prinz, ich war mir nicht sicher. Aber eines war klar, es war eine schwarze Person auf einem historischen Gemälde. Und das hatte ich hier noch nie vorher gesehen, weder im Belvedere noch in einem anderen Museum in Wien. Für mich war diese Figur fast wie eine Erscheinung. Das ist so cool, dachte ich mir, da ist jemand, der so aussieht wie ich. Und das auf einem alten Gemälde in einem Museum. Ich habe ein Foto gemacht und es auf Instagram gepostet. Was ich erst später herausfand, war die Geschichte dieser Person. Oder anders gesagt, die Geschichte hinter dieser Abbildung einer schwarzen Person auf einem historischen Gemälde. Und genau diese Geschichte will ich euch in dieser Audiotour erzählen.
Das war ein Auszug aus der Audiotour und ich habe die große Ehre gehabt, die Produktion dieser Audiotour zu übernehmen. Und Taylor ist die Initiatorin und der Kopf dahinter, die Historikerin. And now we're gonna switch to English because we're gonna do this in English. Hallo Taylor.
Hi, that's so sweet. The mind of the initiative is so cute to say in German. Is that what you said? Like the
yes.
Yeah, okay. I'm like, wow.
That's no, but that's really cool. That's what happened, right? Yeah, you came to the Belvedere, you said, what the fuck is going on here? Nobody's talking about all these black figures in the paintings. If you're not doing it, I'm going to do it. And so you did.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was a really interesting process because honestly, they were wanting to... or began to reflect on the colonial history of the institution, but did not really know how to, and it just was really nice of, it's a nice story of right place, right time, because when I started the project in 2023, I was also doing a fellowship through Kota Gema with the Belvedere 21, and I was approached by someone in the art education department on how to contextualize the colonial history in the museum. But also specifically the black representations that I came to know quite intimately in the space. And so I'm really glad that now there is a public understanding of the history of colonialism in relationship to Belvedere, but also the history of how black people have been traditionally represented in the museum space. So, yeah.
I think we're not going to go so much into the actual connection between the colonial history and Belvedere mm-hmm. and answer question of like, why should we in Austria talk about colonial history? Austria did not have any colonies, right? Because that's exactly a quote from the tour guide and mm-hmm. anybody who is interested in that should go now and listen to the tour.
Exactly. Go listen to the audio tour. Exactly.
But at the same time, I think it's really interesting to think about how museums and institutions could and have not or start slowly to approach this aspect, because you're actually not really coming from an art historian perspective, but from a history perspective, mm-hmm. right? And as well, not from a European perspective, but from a perspective from the States. And I'm really curious about how you came into this whole scenery. Like, you know, because I have the feeling coming from the States to Europe and Europe presenting itself with all this richness and historical buildings and so much history in the architecture itself. And at the same time, being totally disconnected from any black history that Europe still has the feeling that there is no black history in Europe. And if so, it's very recent. And I don't know how, because it's a huge topic, but mm-hmm. if you would just talk a little bit about this change of perspective, so with which perspective you came into this space.
Yeah, I think this is such a interesting approach or question, because also when I'm thinking about the way in which Europe, which of course we're not trying to say all of Europe, etc., but like we're being general for now, but the way in which Europe deals with its black histories and distancing from it is very interesting to me, because the way in which I've always approached history, especially a U.S. history perspective, is that the United States would not exist without Europeans. And so there's a constant disconnect between, as well, the development of the U.S. and how European empire also influenced the way in which the United States developed. So I feel like there's always this weird distancing between Europe and the U.S., but I'm like, we are cousins, very much so. Like the United States would not exist as it does without the impact of European empire. So Spain, the United Kingdom, France, and other Portugal and other empires that came to the Americas. So not even just the United States, but the Caribbean, Central America, and South America. And so I think I've always find it interesting that there's always a way of separating colonial histories from European nation states or from European empires, and also with that, the denial of a black presence, or talking about how black people are connected to the histories of these empires, and also, the wealth that these empires have, because they would not have them without indigenous and black labor as well. And I also find it interesting, because even outside of the context of the transatlantic slave trade, there's still the whole European colonial age from the 1800s as well. So even after the end of the transatlantic slave trade, you still had multiple nations going into the European conference after the Berlin conference, colonizing different parts of Africa. And so I always find this to be strange to deny like an interaction with the African context, with the black context or the Afro-diasporic context. But also the lack of knowledge as well of like a black presence prior to even the transatlantic slave trade. So even if we go back before the beginning of the colonial age, there always was a black presence in Europe. There was always even, especially by way of the Ottoman Empire, more specifically. And so these different interactions have always been present. And I think it's a question of us questioning our own ignorances, our own perspectives, because of course it makes sense that there was a black presence, because we are in an interconnected world. So this idea of like when you're learning about things like the Silk Road, for example, and to think that like there just had to be no Africans present, or like there's no African people present in the Roman Empire, the Greek Empire, when you look at the map of like where these empires expanded to, it makes just complete sense. But we're always very confused, like when people say that there was a black presence or a non-white presence in these areas. So I always find it really interesting when people are confused by this topic or this proposition. Yeah.
It's I mean, I guess it's coming more and more to the European space to think about it. But there is like, during this whole project, I think there were some points where I was just grabbing things that I knew somehow, but I never made any connections. For example, that the Berlin conference, the conference where the European powers met to divide Africa for colonies, was actually taking place just some, I don't know, I think 40 years before the turn of the 20th century and after slavery has been abolished. And that was just so, like, it just opened my mind and my perspective on the world and how close all these histories are connected to us in the today, that it's not a history that is
distant.
Very, it's not distant at all. It's very, very recent history. And I guess it's way more present in the States that you understand that it's been the great grandparents. So you have kind of a lineage where you can understand, okay, it's not my grandparents, but maybe my great, great grandparents. My God, what a word. My great grandparents that were still in slavery or connected to slavery or slave owners maybe or whatever it is. But you probably understand it, have a different understanding of time. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think in my own personal context, like, it's very omnipresent. Like, my grandmother's in her mid-80s right now, and she grew up a sharecropper. So, like, for those who don't know what sharecropping is, it's something that very much came after the ending of slavery, but was in its own way a form of enslavement. So sharecroppers were people who would normally work on the land of people that they were formerly enslaved by, and work a specific plot of land. They would be provided the tools by the former slave master or the person who's allowing them to work the land, but then they have to give almost half or more of their produce to the person who's allowing them to use the land. And also the profits, basically all of it goes to also the person who owns the land, so the plantation owner or whoever it is that owns the land. So there's really no benefit for the people that work these lands. And so my grandmother was a literal sharecropper as well, was picking cotton, all of this. And I feel like it's very interesting because I think even in the States, people still treat it as if it's this very distant history. And I distinctly remember this time in the eighth grade, my grandmother came to show my class how to pick cotton. And my teacher was very disturbed by this, basically, because I think in her mind, she was very much like, this is distant and et cetera. And like, there's no way people still do this. And it's like, there's nothing necessarily wrong with cotton picking as a business or practice, but the way in which my grandmother and her parents were very much exploited in order to produce certain forms of labor was the disturbing part about it. And so, yeah, all these things are very omnipresent in my lineage for sure, especially from families that are in the South or from families that, that whose families are either recently coming out of a low, low socioeconomic status, things like this. So yeah, it's very present. But I also think it is present for families in Europe, just depending on how long people's lineages have been here. So for example, if, especially in Germany, if you have family members from, for example, Namibia or Cameroon that came to work in the 1920s, and then they realized they could not return home because their passports or documents were null and void after the loss of World War I. If that's that's also kind of immediate history as well, that's also passed on to the children that are still in Germany or in other spaces as well. So I think it's more omnipresent, I guess, in the way in which people discuss these different systems, or how much attention the society gives specific issues or who has a voice in different societies. And I feel like in Germany, this voice is becoming more and more loud and omnipresent, especially people who descend from people of the diaspora from that time, so the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. So I think it's also present for them, but it's something that's just now making its way into like mainstream discussions.
Yeah, slowly, but And I mean, it's, I think it really changes something to understand these personal stories that are relatable to like the big, sorry, I have to just put my mic up, to the big historical moments. The other thing that I really, that really stuck to my mind from this tour was a sentence, because I edited it, I can quote directly. It's so funny.
You cannot like, quote, but you can quote all of it. I'm like, yeah, I totally stopped that. It's definitely in the script.
It's there. Because I happened to go to Melk. Do you know Melk?
I love Melk. You saw the, did you see the painting in Melk? Is that what you're talking about?
No.
Oh, okay. I thought
you were. Which painting?
There's the Epiphany painting as well in the Melk Abbey.
Okay.
And you're not allowed to take pictures of it, so I can't show you it, but we should request it at some point. But there is this painting of the Epiphany from, it's like a medieval painting where there's a black person, multiple. So there's the king, but there's also another person accompanying him. To the side. So I thought that's the one you were talking about, but I remember seeing
it.
Is
it a nice painting? It is, or why are you so excited about it?
From what I recall, it was a nice painting, I think. I mean, like, I always get happy to see these paintings, and I'm always happy when I can find them. So yeah, I would say it's a pretty cool painting. Yeah, but I thought that's what you were talking about.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry, I didn't see the painting. But I just went through the whole exhibition, and then mm-hmm. it ends up in the church. Mm-hmm. And the church in Melk is like, it's so golden. It's just gold, gold, mm-hmm. gold everywhere. And I just had to, and I went there like a week after I edited the whole thing, and I just had in my mind this sentence, the Baroque, with all its glory, all its golden shining buildings, is an outcome of many, many years of exploiting overseas territories. Mm-hmm. And I knew somehow, but actually not really. Like, I didn't really understood the richness of the, like, how the richness of the Baroque is connected to colonialism. Because these two events, kind of, or these two historical moments, in my mind, were two separate things. Mm-hmm. And I was really starting to wondering about the church and how they got all this money and how this place like Melk are built. Like, how much money was spent to build this overly golden church. And I don't know if you've always known, coming to see these buildings, because growing up in Austria, I was not aware of any of it. And I would just, I don't know if you always had this perspective, or it was as well some kind of learning towards how to look at this architecture as well.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I learned from studying abroad that oftentimes this is where the wealth is coming from. So I've also studied in Spain, and I've also studied in Poland as well. And so when we're thinking about colonial histories or histories of enslavement, a majority of people normally hyper-focus on basically the atrocities that came as a result of these events, of course. And so I think many people consider involvement or complicity very much so, like, if you physically owned slaves, or if you physically went and usurped land from other people, etc. And mounted a great amount of violence. But we oftentimes don't talk about how that's benefited the countries that participated, but also the exchanges that other spaces, like the Habsburgs, for example, were very much involved in this trade as well. Mm-hmm. And so I think for me, like, something that I thought about a lot with this tour, which I don't know why, like, mentally sometimes your brain doesn't make specific connections, but just like even basic things like crops, like, or like the staple crops that are required for an Austrian diet, for an Italian diet, things like these. These are all New World crops. Potatoes came from the Americas, like tomatoes, these things like that are very central to the diet.
Yeah.
Come from the Americas. So it's like even just everyday things like come from this specific trade, because these are New World crops, or corn, or things like this. And I think we forget just like how everyday things are just so much connected to these colonial exchanges. And I think it really brings up a wider conversation of like, what did it really, like, what is the result of colonialism or this kind of global exchange of goods and like the amount of devastation caused so that people can have corn and like tomatoes and potatoes and different things like this, or gold for the instance of milk and things like this. So I think it's like something to really ponder on, of course, these everyday things that just would not be here without that trade. I mean, of course, it could be, it could have been, but like it was done in an exploitative way. It was not a fair trade, obviously. And so it was a very exploitative process at the time in which these crops were brought to Europe, and also with silver and gold, for example, the way in which it was brought to Europe. And so I think it is interesting to think about like how these everyday things we have, coffee and all these other things, very much came from originally a very, and still, come from a very exploitative process. And we can't really disaggregate that from like modern day slavery that's happening now, like for example, in Congo with the cobalt trade, for example, where you have children as young as 3 years old mining cobalt for our phones, for different electronics that we're using to shoot this today, things like this, and how there's neocolonialism happening and how these processes morph and change over time and still, are still exploitative in many ways. And so I think we don't really think about those things. I think sometimes you just need it pointed out to you, like how these things are connected or their origins or things like this. But I think it is a good point because like, yeah, I think with crops for me this year, I was like, oh yeah, we would not be having this like ad apopupo at the market if it wasn't for like centuries ago, this exchange that happened. So, well, it wasn't exchange, but this exploitation that happened centuries ago. Yeah.
Yeah. Is there something from the tour that stuck with you? Because you're doing it now for quite a while.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing that always sticks with me is the conversations that I get to have after the tours and what people got out of it, or people always bring new questions or different perspectives. But I think it's like the impact that it has. So like the things that like more people wish they knew about, or like how, especially when school age children come as well, and like how insanely smart they are, but also how they're able to relate these historical experiences to their current experiences of like discrimination and things like this, which has come up on some school visits as well, of students coming to the tour as well. And so I think like the impact of the tour itself is like what strikes me the most. Mm-hmm. And because sometimes I'm like thinking of it from just like this purely historical perspective of like, oh, okay, people should know this and this and this. But like when you're thinking about how it really turns wheels for people, and also with how society is structured, and also how to go forward, basically. And I think like that's a big conversation we have in the debrief after the tours, regardless of the age group that I do it with, is like, what do we do now, or how can we move forward now that we have this context? Now I understand like how all these things are connected. What do we do next? Yeah.
Could you give one example of such a question or a situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think like one, yeah, it's kind of like a heavy or thing, but like one of the young people that came was sharing how when we're talking about the discrimination that Black people faced, especially in Germany at the time, and names that they were called and things like this, it was like a young Turkish boy who's living here, and he was talking about how he was called a racial slur by one of the bus drivers coming on, picking him up by Hauptbahnhof as well, and like how that really affects his self-esteem, and like how it's really horrible that like people feel like it's okay to speak about people in that way, and also the way in which Turkish people are represented in media or in conversations with people, really has a big impact on his like personal look on himself. And so he was able to relate in this way. And I was like, that's so sad because he's like 14 years old. So I'm just like, but it was good because he was like, he also was the first time he's able to talk in his class openly about these things. So I think it also opens up different conversations, especially for young people to be like, at least it gives them a space of like, this has happened before, and they have an understanding of where this type of discrimination comes from. So then they know they can discuss it and like try to combat it. So I think it was like really important for them to have this conversation. But yeah, it was really heavy for me though, because I just wasn't expecting them to relate to it in that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you think because of you now giving a tour through the Belvedere and addressing that there is a racist stereotype in this image, that people understand, okay, now there's a person who addresses it and not just, it doesn't go unmentioned, that they could address their own racist experiences.
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Especially with young people, I think we like, especially with that class in particular, like it was a really important conversation, especially with conversations around like Islamophobic, like hate in Austria, anti-blackness, things like this. But many of the youth in this class were coming from Muslim migrant backgrounds as well, and like also talking about their experiences with like their parents wearing hijab and people making specific comments at them or things like this. So the way in which they're represented in media or how people discuss their backgrounds has a effect on them now. And so they were able to relate in the way of like, okay, like this is why these kinds of things, not why, but like an explanation of like, it's not the first time that this has happened and there's ways to deal with it. So like also in the tour, we talk about like how Black people have taken back their representation and represent themselves, or have created art movements to self-represent and creating different narratives or more genuine narratives of like what it means to be a Black person, or how Black people should be represented in media to combat racist stereotypes. And I think for them, it also gives them tools as well to, in their, after they leave the tour in their everyday life, to be like, okay, but also I can take the power back and represent myself or add to more positive representation from my perspective, from my community. And I think like that's really important. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. I'm just like, I'm speechless. No, because I think like, I when you say it, I think I understand that people probably also, like, you need to understand the concept of representation before you can address it.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's probably what you're doing with this tour.
Yeah, I think that, like, it gives people a better understanding of what representation means, and also, like, the impact that it has on people's psychological states, on the way people also, not only on people's personal psychological states, but also the way in which people who are not from these groups treat the other people. So like how images can influence like how we treat one another, how we designate one another, how we build relationships with each other is extremely influenced by the way in which we're represented or how we're talked about by institutions that are tasked with education. So like people cannot disaggregate the fact that like museums are there to teach, or they're at least treated as educational spaces. And if in the space you just see Black people represented as enslaved people or as objects, then that also obviously influences your perspective of like what a Black person can or cannot be represented as. If in media, as we like had the conversation with Simone in the podcast as well, like he was talking about older representations of how Black people were portrayed in Austrian media as drug dealers, as only primarily as sex workers, different representations, very stereotypical and objectifying representations, and how he created, wanted to create more spaces where Black people have a more complex representation as well. So that's why it's important, like spaces like Fresh Vibes or Black Wall Street Info or primarily Black led media outlets also give a non-stereotypical representation of Blackness, which affects like how people treat people. Because if you're only represented as, like, this happens to me, like people ask me all the time when I'm out, because I have locks, do I have weed, can I sell them drugs, this and that. So it's always assumed that I am a drug dealer or have drugs or know someone with drugs, which is not the case. And it's just because of how I look. Like, people make this assumption. This happens with African friends of mine as well, that when we're going out, people ask us these questions. And I know that this is something that's primarily influenced by stereotypes, especially in the media, especially stemming from that point in the 90s with Operation Spring and things like this, where they really did emphasize that, like, the Black presence in Austria is associated with drugs or drug trafficking and things like, or criminality in general. And so I think these representations absolutely have an influence on us still.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there is two things that we need to maybe explain. The mm-hmm. one thing is that you said that there's a podcast, mm-hmm. which means yes. that there's a
sorry.
There's the audio tour, but within the audio tour, there's you made three interviews with three different people that we call deep dives. Mm-hmm. So it's about 25 minutes conversations and really, really interesting. And Simone Inou is one of them. And he's a journalist and Black activist in Austria. And the second thing is Operation Spring, because I think it's really not that known in Austria mm-hmm. outside the Black community. Mm-hmm. There is a really, I don't know, it's been a while since I saw it, but there's a documentary, mm-hmm. which is, I think, very good to watch if you've never heard about Operation Spring. But could you explain it a little bit?
I can give, yes.
Like in 5 sentences.
Try.
Or should I?
And so, from my understanding, so basically there was a police killing of a Nigerian person named Marcus Omofuma, who was killed while being restrained during a deportation on a plane. So he was actually taped to his seat, and also his mouth was covered up as well with tape, and he suffocated to death. And there was a great response to this by the Black community here in Austria at the time. And I believe this was in, sorry if I get the dates wrong, I want to say 1999 or 2000.
I think it was 1999.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. And so there was a great response in terms of activists pushing back against this killing. People took to the streets. And pressed against the government and demanded accountability. And it's also important to note that the FPÖ was in power at this time as well, and was also pushing for more practices of deportations as well. And in response to basically people protesting the way in which this person was murdered and also the deportation of this person, there was a police operation which was one of the largest police operations in Austrian history against Black people. And basically many of them were falsely ascribed as drug dealers. Some were put in jail and some were also deported as well. Mm. And so there was a similar operation that took place, also called Operation Luxor, which also took place two plus years ago, that was against people of Muslim backgrounds as well. So these are like two of the largest police operations that have taken place in Austria, and of course notably taken place against two racialized groups of people. And I think oftentimes people don't realize there's a severe issue of racism in Austria in particular, as well with anti-Blackness and also anti-Muslim sentiment or Islamophobia. And so, yeah, I think that's something that's not common knowledge or something that's not actively talked about from a critical perspective, let's say that. I think people do know that, like, the sentiment exists, but it's not really critically discussed. Mm. Yeah.
I think it's especially not really discussed on how these events, like Operation Spring, like, really shaped a lot of people and shaped a lot of, a whole generation,
mm-hmm.
I think. But at the same time, it's not really known in the white part of Austria. Mm-hmm. And it's, I think it was also connected to the police being able to, for the first time, listen in to phone calls.
Wiretapping.
Wiretapping, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they used it extensively and they interpreted into like normal conversations what they wanted to interpret into. So mm-hmm. if people said like, okay, let's go meet for dinner, it was supposed to be the code word for meeting to sell drugs.
Which is ridiculous.
Which is so crazy. Like, it's, yes. Okay. Where do we go from here?
Heavy topics, but yeah, no, I mean...
Heavy topics.
Yeah,
but this interview with Simone Inou is so beautiful. Mm-hmm. Like, he is an amazing person to have here. And I really, really recommend listening to it because he went through Operation Spring and he as well said that his house was raided by the police mm-hmm. during that time. And he still... I don't know, he's...
So active still and still fighting and still...
Yeah, but yeah. in such a beautiful way mm-hmm, mm-hmm. with so much... I don't know, what's the word? Like, he's extroverting. No, there's a word
extraordinary?
Like...
Extraordinary?
No, like, he's like, he's a ray of sunlight.
Oh,
I don't know. Like,
he has a great energy.
He has such great energy. Yeah,
Simone Inou has fantastic vibes. I don't know how else to describe it, but like, he's such a cool person to sit down and talk to and learn from. Like, I feel like every time that I see him, I learn something new, or because we go for coffee sometimes every now and then, or bump into each other at events and things. And I'm like, I'm always learning so much every single time I have a conversation with him. But I also think it's just really inspiring the amount of like the fact that he has still so much energy to continue to push forward. And he has so many programs that he's trying to accomplish. That I think it's really amazing. Speaking of which, he has the anti-racism days coming up at the beginning of next year at CU, so you guys should also check that out. Yeah, but there's that. So
yeah,
but he's really awesome.
And I mean, one thing that he also says is about him being an archivist and mm-hmm. him trying to establish a Black History archive. Mm-hmm. And I don't know where this is leading to in his life, mm-hmm. but maybe that would be the last question for you. And like, what's your path forward? Like, do you know where do you want to go from giving tours through the Belvedere, talking about colonial history?
Yeah, I mean, I think like I'm also really interested in archiving or archivist histories, and I also do documentary and film and things like this. So I think I just want to keep collecting stories and keep doing research and keep pushing through and like discovering new stories. Or I just think it's important to like establish these histories. I think it's important to keep talking about them. I think it's important to educate people because I just see the influence, the impact that it does have. And I think sometimes I think about the fact that the tour is only an hour long, and the amount of like knowledge people get, or like the impact that it has. And sometimes I'm like, well, damn, like I wish like if there's a course or something, or like, you know, like, I mean, we have the audio tour, but even like a long form podcast or something. Like, there's just so many ways to disseminate this information and do a more of a deep dive, because I feel like with each stop could be like multiple hours long. Yeah, discussions, because it very much is like surface level Black presence 101 Austria, but like it's mm-hmm. super surface level. I mean, I feel like there's very like there's so many things that we can get into. So I think for me personally, I also just want to continue the research and learn more, and also even thinking about expanding on thinking about Black presence in Central Europe more broadly. I think would also be interesting to think about as well. But yeah, I don't know. I just feel like there's so many ways that things can go, and I'm only 26, so
this
time, I don't know. Yeah, so let's see. Yeah.
Cool. Thank you so much for being on this podcast.
And thank you for producing the podcast and the audio tour and all the amazing things you do.
Yeah. I was so glad. I had such a good time working with you.
Oh.
It was really amazing time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.